Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-7158, National Railroad Passenger Corporation Appellant versus Lexington Insurance Company, et al. Mr. Belain for the appellant, Mr. Wilmer for the appellate.
Good morning, Your Honors. William Belain for the appellant, National Railroad, or Amtrak. Your Honors, I'm going to focus on two overarching issues. The first one's going to be whether summary judgment should have been granted as a matter of law on the contention that Amtrak violated notice condition 3, small Roman numeral 2. I'm going to call it 3-2 for convenience, if I may. That's the notice of claim provision. That has two aspects. One is whether the provision was unambiguous, as the court held and as the defendants have contended. And then the second aspect of that is going to be whether, even if it is unambiguous in favor of the defendants, whether there was a waiver by the conduct, or at least a triable issue of fact of waiver by reason of the conduct of the defendants. The second overarching issue is going to be this issue of D.C. law and the question of whether or not you have to prove prejudice before you can disclaim based on notice. And that one, obviously, as we've raised in our papers, is in the context of excess insurers, no condition precedent provision, and a variety of other things, but things that we say make this very...
You have a hard time finding anything in D.C. law that supports that proposition, though, don't you?
There are cases that support the proposition with respect to a primary policy in which...
You have a hard time finding anything in D.C. law that supports that proposition, don't you?
All I have to do is look at Waters, Your Honor. If I look at Waters and you read Waters in a faithful way, you're going to see that it's absolutely covered.
Are you accusing me of reading it in an unfaithful way if I don't see it?
I trust you will read it in a faithful way, and that when you do, we will
I'll
prevail
let you
on this issue.
I'll get back to your first point.
All right.
But you brought your second point up, so you asked for it, so go ahead.
Oh, no. I'm delighted to take shots as long as I can politely give
them out. Then let me take a shot. Why wouldn't you give notice to your excess carriers? What was the possible reason for not giving them notice when you get the settlement demand? And then when counsel for Amtrak suggests that you all give notice and you didn't, I don't understand. What's the reason why one wouldn't give notice?
They simply didn't. In other words, there was not a rationale that says we don't want to give notice for a reason. And I don't doubt that you can tell insureds, you know what, give them notice every 2 minutes of everything. And that, by the way, is obviously
one of... But that's not your situation here. You had a claim that spoke in terms of dollar values expressed in dollars exceeding the threshold for notice. And I'm like Judge Griffith. I have a real difficult time understanding why you didn't give notice.
Right.
I mean, it was there in the policy, and if you read it and said, well, we might not have to, you should also have been able to say, you know, we might have to, and there is a very low cost to file in use charges on an insurance policy. If we're not a bunch of fools trying to defeat the purpose of the policy, we're going to give notice.
I understand. We can look back in retrospect and say the easier thing would have been to give notice. I'm not going to stand here and tell you that there was a particular downside that put us in a difficult situation. What we did understand was that when you look at 3-2, it did not tell us unambiguously that we had to give notice simply because we got a demand for $6 million. That I will represent to you, and that we believe. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Are you looking at the same 3-2 that's in the file?
Your Honor, if I saw somebody draft 3-2 for me, and they handed it to me and said, this is supposed to mean that every time you get a demand for X dollars, you've got to give notice, I tell them to go back and redraft.
What does the phrase any amount claimed mean?
I understand that, but my problem is with the for purposes of this condition 3-2. What does that mean?
The insured must also give immediate notice to underwriters whenever the insured has information from which the insured should reasonably conclude that a claim alone or in combination with other claims is equal to or greater than the amount stated in item 5B of the declarations. And you had a claim on paper, indeed eventually a lawsuit, stating a value in excess of by itself without aggregation in excess of the amount of the policy.
I don't understand
what you don't understand.
Your Honor, if you were just reading from the first paragraph, and I think you were, that first paragraph is clearly a valuation paragraph which says, should reasonably conclude.
But
we did not,
word,
we say,
it,
yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
It doesn't use the word value like condition 3.1 does.
Yeah.
Well,
condition 3.1 has the word value.
One and two. Condition 3.1.
Isn't that right? It doesn't use the word value.
It doesn't, but if you look at the Lloyd's, but if you look at the Lloyd's policy cross-references you to the declarations page, and the declaration page does refer to 3.2 as
the
plain valuation level.
We're looking at 3.2, and you got through telling us that 3.2 wouldn't have triggered anybody to give notice. It was ambiguous. I read it. I can't find the ambiguity.
Judge,
we spend our whole lives up here with federal agencies that say a no-smoking sign has ambiguity in it, but I don't see any ambiguity.
Judge, the world is filled. I'm not going to stay on the argument if Your Honors have looked at it and said it's unambiguous. We've got cases all over the country where one court's going to say something's ambiguous and another is going to say
it's
not.
Yeah, any that have said a provision worded like this is ambiguous. If you do, why didn't you cite it?
No, it's not like I can go do
that. You don't have courts all over the country that have said that's ambiguous. Now, counsel, don't take.
No, you understand what I'm saying.
Don't pour water on my boot and tell me it's raining.
Okay. And then the other argument that at least I'd like to point out is that waiver argument where we look at that July 27th.
Before we get to that.
Yes, sir.
As I understood your brief, one of your theories about the ambiguity in this clause is that this first paragraph is surplusage under the.
Yes. In other words, when you read the first, there's no question that it's looking for a reasonable value.
Well, do you ever get. Oh.
Should reasonably conclude.
Why does that make it surplusage? I thought your theory was that.
Well, as a practical matter, it does, because you're always going to have demands, always, exceed what a defendant would say is a reasonable value of a claim. It's just a matter of experience. I think that's a fair comment.
I don't understand your point. I thought your point was that if the second paragraph means what the carrier here says it means, then the first paragraph has no meaning.
Right.
It doesn't add anything.
Right. Not only does it not add anything, it rubs it out.
Why doesn't it add anything?
It rubs it out because the first paragraph assumes that it's important for us to reasonably conclude.
Do you ever get claims that don't have an amount on them yet? Do you get
yes.
It?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
yes, fair enough.
Is that where the first paragraph would then apply?
Fair. That would be a fair comment.
So didn't I just give the first paragraph meaning?
But what percentage of the cases are you... What percentage of the cases are you going to have where not only do you not get a demand that's part of the complaint, but you also don't get or solicit a demand early in the litigation? It's part and parcel of litigation.
Counsel, breadth is not equivalent to ambiguity. Just because a clause will create a lot of breadth does not mean it's either ambiguous or superfluous.
Well,
means it creates a lot of bread.
If your honors aren't going to convince me, but guess what? I don't count. Your honors do count. If your honors are absolutely convinced it's unambiguous, there's nothing more I can say about that issue. I would like to go to the waiver issue, and I do stand behind what we said in terms of that first paragraph, absolutely putting it on the claims people to make a reasonable conclusion, and then the second paragraph. We contend, in substance, saying, forget that completely. Whatever they demand, that's the valuation
amount.
Before
you depart from this one, assume for a minute there were any ambiguity. Why wouldn't anyone in the world have reasonably concluded that a claim that had a dollar amount stated in it fit within that paragraph?
No. Your Honor, we've got to claim handlers. Their job is to assess reasonable value.
For lots of reasons. Yeah, I'm aware of that.
Right. And
I've represented insurers and I've represented insureds.
And you don't pick a reasonable value based on somebody's demand.
Right.
You sit there and you
say anything about payment here. This says that could reasonably conclude that a claim loan or income is equal to or greater than the amount. There's claim value.
Right.
And that's the first thing you put in your scorebook, and then you eventually work down to what the reasonable value that you want to reserve for. But I can understand why your evaluators under paragraph 3.1 would have a lot to do with
right.
what's reasonably worth. But
right.
3.2,
well,
you're talking about claim fee.
All right.
I don't see why, even if it's construed the way you want it to be, I don't see why you don't still lose.
Yeah, and I'm very comfortable with the argument that based on our valuations over time, by good, intelligent, very capable, experienced claim handlers.
They ought to be capable enough to read the claim and see what the dollar value was stated in it. And that would seem to be all they'd have to do to meet
well,
this.
That is a different issue. They didn't reasonably conclude that $6 million was a reasonable value.
And that might
and neither
be
did the defense counsel.
That might be defensible under 3.1, though certainly it might be at worst a fact
yeah.
question, I guess. But. Under right. 3.2, I don't see how that helps.
Well, I respectfully disagree. On the waiver issue, we've pointed out the July 27, 2000 letter, which is A1670. We have said that when they give a letter that says the relevant claim provision is 3.1, and it would really help if you people would agree to having us interview under oath people so that we could expedite the resolution of the coverage defenses, that they had a duty, because there already was a verdict exceeding their amounts, they had a duty at that point to at least be forthright enough to say, you know what, we're actually not telling you about all of the notice defenses we have. We have concluded under 3.2 already, and they must have concluded already, if your honors are right about what it means, they must have concluded already that they were going to disclaim based on 3.2 when they're not raising 3.2 and they're raising 3.1.
You seem to be arguing that in order to preserve 3.2, they had to waive everything else.
No.
Right, they claimed everything else, and you say that waives 3.2.
No.
So if they had not claimed everything else, they would not have waived 3.2?
No. Their letter was very specific about 3.1. We've recited it in the brief. You can read it. It doesn't take long. It clearly says the relevant provision is 3.1 on the notice issue. And we'd like to expedite the resolution of this issue. You don't have to consent to having statements made, interviews under oath, but we'd really like it because that'll resolve expeditiously this coverage issue. We're saying they had a duty at that time to say, we'll tell you all the same things, but we're also going to warn you that there's another notice provision, and we think it applies already just based on the fact that you got a $6 million demand.
How did you rely to your detriment on that letter?
Well, two ways. The first thing,
the letter came after you had already failed to give the notice.
Absolutely.
So how did you rely to any detriment? How did your client rely to any detriment on that?
We would say the detriment would simply be one that we submitted to the to all the interviews, and two, we did have the option of accelerating the process for bringing a DJ action by saying, wait a minute, they've raised 3.2. We don't think we're right. We're not going to wait until the usual attachment provision applies and bring an action then. We're going to bring an action earlier because, frankly, the earlier we get a resolution, the better off we are. That would be the notice. But there's no question we'd already, sent out the notice. So it's not like the prejudice was that we didn't send out a notice. But we have argued both estoppel and waiver, intentional relinquishment of a known right. And
state for me briefly how they relinquished their known right. When did they have to assert
if,
it that they didn't?
If they had a if when they sent that letter with those representations, hadn't sent that letter, they had no problem.
If they hadn't sent that letter, so again, you're saying that by raising their other possible defenses, they waive this defense.
With a very specific
is
statement.
Is there any case law out there that an insurer can do that in a letter that by raising one set of defenses in a letter they've waived other possible?
I did not have a specific case to cite, but I also am not aware of any situation where we've had an insurer write a letter like this. Okay? And if you look at their letter, it's not like they cited anything in any case law that said that, this is the kind of thing that we want to do. They had no right to have statements. We're just asking for good faith, that's all.
What's the significance of this sentence in the letter that says, nothing contained within our letter should be construed by you as a waiver?
The answer is, in this context, it is not enough to protect yourself because they have already specifically said the relevant provision is the waiver provision. It clearly would apply with respect to other issues that are not in Condition 3, Your Honor.
What I was looking for was that waiver sentence that you just read.
It does not apply to Condition 3. In other words, you can't look at
it in
a vacuum.
Nothing in this letter should be construed as a waiver of any rights under the policy. Isn't that what it says?
Judge,
my
position is simply that if you've got a duty of utmost good faith and you write a letter that specifically draws attention to another provision in 3.1, and you say, this is the relevant provision, and this is what we're asking you to do. We don't have the right to ask you.
Did they say this is the only relevant position?
They said it's the relevant provision.
Did they not say what Judge Tatel just read to you about there being no waiver?
We are claiming it.
Whoa, wait a minute. Yes, answer Judge Tatel's question. Does it not have that sentence in there about not waiving any other?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, what do you construe that to mean?
I would reasonably construe it to be effective with respect to all of their defenses, and they had others, that didn't relate to Condition 3. If you look at their earlier letter, they've got three different defenses.
Yeah,
all right? And this one, they have focused our attention on the notice defense.
At a time when you were still in the preliminary stages, when you were not making any demands on the excess carrier yet, they raised some of the questions that they would have later, and you're saying they waived all the others by not raising all of them at that time? Is that your
Is what I'm saying.
That states your position.
That is what I'm saying.
Now, leave your red lights on now.
My time is out. I take it you did not want to hear further.
We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if you would like.
I would. Thank you.
We'll hear from the appellee.
May it please the court. My name is Frederick Wilmer. I represent the appellees. I'll refer to the appellees collectively as the insurers, mostly for my ease of. Amtrak's argument calls to mind an old adage in the legal profession: if the facts are against you, argue the law. If the law is against you, argue the facts. And if the law and the facts are against you, pound the table and yell like hell. As Judge Huvel determined below, the undisputed factual record and applicable law can only lead to the following conclusions: that Amtrak's notice was late under the policy, that this breached the policy's notice conditions, and that they're entitled to deny coverage without having to show prejudice.
Why didn't you all identify Condition 3.2 earlier than you did? Doesn't that suggest that maybe there is some ambiguity here? You all missed it, right?
At the point, if we're going back now in time to July 2000, and actually preceding July 2000, continuing forward, this matter, as the underlying litigation showed, was a far complex dispute than the one that's currently pending. There are numerous issues, or at least three central issues with sub-issues that needed to be investigated. The issue regarding Condition 3.1, which, again, we at this point do not believe it's the applicable notice condition with respect to claims, but there was a significant question at the time as to when the accident should have been notified, even before a claim had been made. This was a very significant accident. It was a grade crossing accident with injuries that required helicopter lifting to a hospital.
You think the facts were too confusing for you all to identify 3.2 and let them know that 3.2 was the basis for declining coverage?
There was no duty to decline coverage at the time.
But when you sent the letter and you focused on 3.1, why didn't you focus on 3.2 if it's so clear?
Well, partially for that reason, and partially for the reason that there are other issues that needed to be investigated. And quite honestly, Amtrak hasn't conceded, as the arguments before this court indicate, has conceded that 3.2 operated the way it operated. Or the way that the wording seems to suggest. In other words, Condition 3.2 has been argued to be the equivalent of 3.1. There was a significant amount of information that needed to be digested, investigated, and researched, reviewed regarding the valuation of this case. You know, when Amtrak reasonably should have concluded, and there's a lower threshold under Condition 3.1 as well. That's the million-dollar threshold. And, you know, at the point in time, and quite honestly, the investigation proceeded subject to a complete reservation of rights. And in any event, this course of conduct argument is an attempt to introduce extrinsic evidence beyond an inadmissible extrinsic.
You won't concede that you all just missed it and that you've gotten lucky here.
I'm not quite sure if that's the case, but...
Would you all have done anything differently than you did had you been put on notice?
Earlier on?
Yeah, earlier on.
Absolutely. You know, there are rights within the policy, and one of the
what
things...
What would you have done?
Exactly what was testified to earlier in the case, both litigations, hired monitoring counsel, liaised with Amtrak. Under Condition 9, the operative defense condition, there is no absolute control over the defense of claims that vest with Amtrak. It's a partnership. It gives the insurers the ability...
Participated in the settlement, settlement negotiation process, had you had the chance to do so.
We're like the court in Prince George's County, the Maryland case that we both parties cite to, it literally is impossible to go back into time and say, yes, this is what we would have done, this is what Amtrak would have done. Quite honestly, it's an impossible burden to go back, but you have rights, and evisceration of rights is what the Prince George's County Court was concerned with. Other courts, New York courts that have dealt with the excess insurance late notice issue. Here, those rights were eviscerated. And quite honestly, it's an unfair burden to have to go back and say what we would have done, and which, again, plays right into the arguments that Amtrak has raised here. And those arguments are that it's about what you did. We didn't provide notice. We weren't able to effectuate a settlement of a claim.
I remember correctly that there was at least evidence the claim could have been settled within policy limit or below excess.
Absolutely. Well, you have a demand. I mean, you start
so
with
you
the demand
have made
of
demand
six.
Demand for settlement below excess limits.
And that ultimately is the point here. I mean, we talk about the prejudice issue. Prejudice isn't a factor in the District of Columbia. There's no doubt that it's adhered throughout. Yeah, the past three decades to the no prejudice rule. But, you know, in terms of and prejudice jurisprudence, if we want to call it that, throughout the country, there are different permutations of the rule. But here we're left with the reality that there is a claim that could have, should have been resolved within the excess attachment point and ultimately resulted in a policy limits exposure for my clients. You know, at that point in time, the horse was out of the barn, and it was well across the
field.
You
would at least have papered the file with demands for settlement below excess limits if you had the opportunity to be, whether you had ultimately prevailed on those or not.
Could repeat the question.
You would at least have papered the file with demands on your insurance to settle before below excess limits if you had.
If that's what was called for at the time, yes. At the very least, we would have strongly advocated for a reasonable settlement approach here. You know, the damages and injuries involved here were clearly in excess, I mean, certainly over $1 million. As defense counsel handled this case, the damages, the recommendations regarding settlement had gotten graver as time went on. $500,000 settlement offer on the eve, you know, in the run-up to a trial that, I mean, forget about the result here, where the demand and the damages clearly warranted a multi-million dollar offer was unreasonable under any analysis.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel.
Okay.
I think we have your argument. We'll give appellate back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Your Honor. First, they could have at least set the demand for settlement. The fact of the matter is, one, that demand would be meaningless because they had no ability to enforce separately because there's no hammer clause, which their own expert testified can be a provision that you can have in a policy that would be effective to force an insured to settle. There's no such clause. And just as important, Your Honor, how come they didn't send a letter like that even after they came in and sat as associate counsel, associating this matter for 20 months. They didn't send any letter like that at any time. At most important, I think you can look at A1679-80. That's the mediation letter that we sent on March 21 of 2000. We tell them what we think the case is worth. We invite them to give us their views. They don't say a word.
In any event, that would be germane only to the prejudice issue.
Yes, right? Absolutely. But it does go to our point where we say, show us what the prejudice is. All they say is from page 38 of their brief is essentially we lost the opportunity to use our voice. That's all it is. We can politely listen. But if they don't come forward and say something like, here's the piece of information that we've already found that they didn't have, and if we told them about it, that might have made a difference. Here's the particular expertise we have, like in Prince George's County, the excess insurer had. Here's the expertise we have to bear. Here's what our experience tells us. Did you guys think of that? That might make a difference. But you don't have those facts. We feel very strongly that there would be a disputed issue of fact in every one of those cases that are decided as a matter of law that you look at, be it Prince George's or any other case, are situations that are markedly different, like there are already demands that are excess of the excess carrier's liability. In any event, I do commend the court to look at those district cases on the issue of prejudice, no prejudice, especially Judge McGowan's decision in Waters. Absolutely.
Counsel, your time is up again.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Counsel.